DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Nick Martin in Germany. On today's programme, Russia's airspace incursions spark a call for action among NATO members.
If we see that drone or missile actually endangers NATO member states and there is a way to shoot down or to tackle this issue, then we must do that.
How will Moldova's razor-edge yes vote on EU membership impact the runoff in the country's presidential election? And as hundreds of thousands flee Israel's offensive in Lebanon, Turkey awaits its next refugee crisis.
Another wave of refugees means what? A lot of spending, a lot of inflation. Other than this, societal security. So that's why Turkey will not tolerate another wave.
Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky last week took his victory plan to Brussels, hoping for more support from the European Union and NATO. The proposals envisage Kyiv being offered a formal invitation to join the military alliance, a lifting of bans on Ukrainian forces using long-range weapons supplied by the West deep inside Russia, and a refusal to give up Ukrainian territory. But as Terry Schultz reports, it's not just Zelensky pressuring NATO. Some of the alliance's members are also asking for more support.
NATO plays a big role in Ukrainian President Zelensky's plan for how to end Russia's war against his country. As he's been requesting for years now, he wants an immediate invitation for Ukraine to join the alliance. That's the first priority in the document he's presented to governments. And, of course, he wants more weapons to fight the daily deadly attacks by Russia. Standing next to new NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte at NATO headquarters last week, Zelensky explained his new push for help.
Right now, inviting Ukraine to join NATO would strengthen us diplomatically, bring us closer to real and, what is very important, fair peace. Being determined is the surest path to peace, and this is a realistic path. Everything Ukrainians have achieved so far seemed impossible not so long ago.
At the moment, a near-term invitation to join NATO with war still raging does seem impossible, with only the Baltic states and Poland openly supporting it and heavyweight allies, the U.S. and Germany, opposing it. So all Secretary General Rutte had to offer Zelensky last week was moral support and a reminder that NATO has pledged an invitation to Kyiv will be offered someday.
And until then, we will continue to do all that we can to assure Ukraine prevails. This is vital for our shared security.
In the meantime, that shared security is also shared insecurity. With Russia's constant barrage of missiles and drones against Ukraine, there's been an increasing number of incursions into NATO's own airspace, intentional or not. It's led to NATO staging the first ever air defense exercise, Ramstein Flag 2024, simulating a conflict in the skies over Allied territory. It took place in Greece, and I got to be there. These pilots were enthusiastic about the experience.
Some fighter jets waiting for us in the air, so ground-to-air threat, air-to-air threat, and then some boats trying to engage us as well.
We fly and fight with real scenarios, more or less realistic scenarios, and that's really good.
It's not hard to come up with realistic scenarios. NATO conducted more than 300 intercepts of Russian planes approaching Allied airspace last year, and Russian drones have crashed in NATO countries. It's unknown whether they were meant to be there or were aimed at Ukraine and got off track. Either way, says NATO's Rutte.
It is a worrying development, unacceptable.
NATO's eastern flank countries have already reinforced their land borders with Russia and Belarus with physical barriers. Now they're planning to mount a wall of drones, too, for vigilance against the airspace insecurity. Some say they're ready to shoot down aerial intruders. Other NATO allies further away from the conflict line are not comfortable with that. Latvian President Edgars Rinkevičs told DW Simon Young that he wants more clarification about what NATO is prepared to do after a drone armed with explosives crashed in his country last month.
There is no clear policy at this point at NATO level, and that's why you get those calls by Polish representatives, by Romanian representatives, now by the Baltic representatives, first of all, to get a clear NATO stance. And I think that if we see that drone or missile actually endangers NATO member states, and you see that there is a way how to shoot down or to tackle this issue, then we must do that. Because your example of the drone that actually crashed in the territory of Latvia, that was a drone with 50 kilograms of explosives. So it, imagine the situation if it would crash on small village or town in the eastern part of Latvia, and there would be casualties.
Rutte is working to coordinate divergent positions at NATO.
This is up to each member state to work on this, but clearly there's also a role for NATO to make sure that we are informed, that we are updated.
In the meantime, the alliance is making sure its capabilities are updated. For German Colonel Jörg Schiratzky, Ramstein flag reminded him of the huge Cold War drills that were shelved during more peaceful years.
Unfortunately, things have changed, and we need these exercises like this to ensure that we are trained, to ensure that we can provide deterrence and lastly defense of NATO territory.
He says he hopes to see a return to peace in NATO's neighborhood, but that's not what anyone's seeing on the horizon. Terry Schultz, DW, at Androvita Air Base in Greece.
Now to another nation with a troubled relationship with the Kremlin. Moldova last weekend held the first round of its presidential election, along with a referendum on the country's plans to eventually join the EU. President Maia Sandu called the vote to shore up political support and try and get Moldova's EU ambitions enshrined in the constitution. Early results last Sunday night revealed a definite no to the plans, which Sandu blamed on Russian interference. But then the votes of the Moldovan diaspora came in late and the measure passed by a whisker. For more on the confusion this caused, I spoke to Denis Chinușa, a political analyst at the Eastern Europe Study Centre in Vilnius.
The idea to have the referendum by some segments of the society was seen as unnecessary. It was not asked by the EU, and really nobody, even in the extra-parliamentary pro-EU opposition, supported this idea. So therefore, we had a number of people that voted against the referendum as well as boycotted the referendum. So of about 49% turnout for the referendum, we had about 50% of those who supported it, and that represent only 25% of the population. So we have 75% that are either against, boycotted it, or didn't take part in the referendum. And this tells you a little bit about how polarized is the society in terms of geopolitics as well.
And Denis, Moldovan President Maia Sandu accused Russian-backed groups of trying to buy votes and sabotage the referendum. How much evidence is there for this, and what kind of tactics were deployed to disrupt the vote?
Well, these accusations are very serious. The problem is that these allegations were not backed up by strong evidence. And this creates a lot of troubles for the government and for Maia Sandu herself, because she made the statement that 300,000 people were influenced. So their votes were basically stolen or bribed. This was not yet proven in the courts or with some evidence showing that clearly. What we know for sure is that the political groups related to the fugitive Shore, Ilan Shore, who is based in Moscow, that they are working on the ground and they are quite efficient. Although the government and the law enforcement agencies are showing the different results of dismantling their groups, of investigating these cases, this doesn't lead to a positive result for the political and electoral processes in Moldova, which also is indicating the fact that Russia is capable to do more than the Moldovan authorities are able to actually stop.
I mean, that is incredibly serious, especially for a small country like Moldova.
Yeah, that's very dangerous because we speak about the security, national security of the country, and we understand very well that the malign interference in a country, it is done mainly through influencing the political processes, and altering the electoral results is a way to meddle in the domestic affairs of a country. What we also understand that despite the support that Moldova received from the Western partners, which was immense in terms of intelligence sharing, as well as training of newly created institutions that are countering disinformation, this was not enough. So if we speak about Moldova being under constant attacks of Russia since 2021, when it orchestrated different crises, including the energy one. Why we still don't see people fired for not doing a good job? Why the government is not improving its activity in actually stopping Russia from doing that? These are question marks that we have to put in order to really address this issue very seriously and try to somehow reduce as much as possible Russian hybrid interference in the country's domestic affairs.
So you mentioned that there are several groups that have been started to try and resist this misinformation from Russia. But what else can the government do?
Well, I think that first of all, we have to admit that the country is facing serious social economic issues. About one third of the population are living under the absolute poverty. So about 30-something percent of the population are vulnerable to different political interferences. So obviously, when a person that lives in such a level of poverty is promised 50 euros to vote or to do some political activity, that person, they are going to do that, not because they are particularly pro-Russia, but because they don't have other choice, which means that social policies of the country have to be probably revised, as well as there should be a certain degree of understanding by the government that we have to ensure these equal opportunities. And when the government is increasing its salaries up to several thousand euros while not doing enough for the rest of the population, then obviously we will see, you know, a certain degree of discrepancy.
Well, Denis, it did look like the no's were going to win, but thanks to the Moldovan diaspora, the yes vote scraped through with a razor-thin majority. So what happens now?
Now is the turn of the Constitutional Court to validate this referendum. Obviously, we have different political forces that question the results and the fact that only two voting stations were open in Russia, comparative to hundreds that were open in the West. But obviously, this is not something that the Constitutional Court will take into account. I believe that it will validate the referendum, and this will mean that we will have this provision enshrined in the Constitution.
And of course, a presidential election was also being held on the same day as the referendum, with Sandu coming out top in the first round. She now faces pro-Russian rival Alexander Stoyanoglo in the runoff. To what extent does this referendum result weaken Sandu?
She is the author of this referendum. She was using the referendum for her own electoral campaign in the presidential elections. I would really think that we have to look closely to what is Stoyanoglo representing. I don't think that he is really pro-Russian, because if you listen to him, he is supporting the balanced foreign policy. He understands that being isolated to supporting only one geopolitical orientation is quite risky in order to win the election. So he is supported by pro-Russian political forces. That is true. They are the socialists. But I think that both socialists and other forces, including the pro-EU extra-parliamentary forces, they may vote for Stoyanoglo because he is the opposition to Maya Sandu. So it will not be Stoyanoglo because he is pro-Russian. By the way, he is also a citizen of Romania, and his daughters are working in the EU institutions. He is using the narratives that are sometimes confused as being pro-Russian. And I think that he's supported very much by the pro-Russian because he is the winning card in this competition against Maya Sandu that many don't want to see as somebody being re-elected.
And of course, the runoff for Moldova's presidential election takes place on November the 3rd. And I was talking there to Denis Chinuza, a political analyst at the Eastern Europe Study Centre in Vilnius. DW. Now to France, where a woman who was drugged and raped by her ex-husband and then subjected to similar abuse by dozens of men over a nine-year period has taken the stand. Gisèle Pelicot has become an icon of women's rights since the trial opened last month in the southern city of Avignon. The 71-year-old told the court she'd been broken by her ordeal, but is also determined to change how society treats sexual assault victims. From Paris, John Lawrenson reports.
"I'm a totally destroyed woman," said 71-year-old Gisèle Pelicot when she took the stand in the criminal court of Vaucluse in the south of France. Her husband, Dominique Pellicot, who is also 71, has admitted that on a number of occasions from 2011 to 2020, he drugged her, raped her, and invited dozens of unknown men to do the same. 50 men between the ages of 36 and 74 are on trial with Pellicot, in a case that began in September and is expected to continue until December. They, like the husband, risk 20 years in prison. In the latest twist in this case that has horrified France, Mrs. Pellicot said that although she'd prepared for this trial, she still couldn't comprehend her husband's actions. Addressing him directly for the first time since the start of the trial, she said, "Dominique, we had 50 years of life together. I was a happy and fulfilled wife. We had 3 children, 7 grandchildren. You were for me a kind and attentive man. I always thought I could trust you." At that point, she was overcome with emotion but kept going. "How many times I said to myself how lucky I was to have you by my side. How could you have let people into our house? For me, that betrayal is immeasurable." In rape cases, victims are offered the possibility of giving their testimony behind closed doors. Madame Pellicot insisted on speaking publicly because it was not the victims who should feel ashamed, she said, but the perpetrators. Some of the other accused men said they believed they were taking part in a fantasy shared by the couple. Others said they did not realise she was unconscious. Dominique Pellicot was arrested after filming up women's skirts in a supermarket. The police confiscated his telephones. On one, they found a Skype account with a pseudonym where he talked about drugging his wife, and the police decided to investigate further. After raiding his home and confiscating his computer, they found a number of films of the abuse of his wife that are now being used as evidence in court. The verdict is expected on the 20th of December. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
Still to come, Turkey gears up for another possible refugee crisis. And a reminder that DW's website and social media pages have the latest news from across Europe. So that's dw.com and DW Europe on socials. I'm Nick Martin in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
European politics. It's complicated, right?
Luckily, there's a podcast that helps make sense of it.
It's called The Europeans.
Every week, we break down the biggest stories in European politics.
Can I disagree slightly with the premise of your question?
Go for it.
I think some European leaders may actually prefer Donald Trump.
And some quirky non-political stories you probably missed.
Vilnius, the G-spot of Europe. Nobody knows where it is, but once you find it, it's amazing.
The Europeans.
New episodes every Thursday.
With Israel continuing its offensive in Lebanon, the United Nations says over 400,000 Lebanese people have now sought sanctuary in Syria. The prospect of a new refugee crisis is causing concern in neighbouring Turkey, which is already hosting millions from other regional conflicts, including the Syrian civil war. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
As Israel continues its offensive in Lebanon, more civilians flee the conflict to neighbouring Syria. The United Nations say over 400,000 have fled. Many are Syrians who had sought sanctuary in Lebanon from the civil war in their own country. Aid workers warn the numbers could surge if fighting continues, overwhelming Syria and forcing more refugees into Turkey, creating a humanitarian crisis. Metin Çorabatur of the Ankara-based Research Center on Asylum and Migration.
In Lebanon, there have been nearly 1 million Syrian refugees since 2011. So already we are not talking only about Syrian refugees going back to Syria, but Lebanese population is crossing the border to Syria, and Syria would either try to close the borders or just force them north to go to Turkish borders. These are really catastrophic situation for people. Poor countries may pull Turkey into more tensions with Israel.
Refugees have started arriving at camps in northeast Syria, close to the Turkish border. The Washakoni camp was created for refugees from the Syrian civil war, but officials there say they are now being overwhelmed. Abdul Razak Mohammed is the administrator of the camp.
We are forced to receive them because they are refugees who've escaped the war and have nowhere to go. We don't have a single tent left. We cannot receive one extra person, but we don't have a choice.
Neighbouring Turkey already hosts an estimated 5 million refugees, including upwards of 3 million Syrians. And there's a growing public backlash against their presence. Earlier this year, tensions erupted into violence against refugees. And let's say the issue has become a major political liability for the government. Metin Çorabatur again.
Politically, since the last recent two elections, the asylum issue has become a big debate, and opposition was very active to create a negative perceptions about refugees. And this forced government more to security and fight against irregular migration.
This March, the government lost heavily in nationwide local elections, a defeat widely blamed on high double-digit inflation and hostility towards refugees. Ankara has just constructed a wall along its Syrian border to prevent further refugees from entering Turkey. But hosting refugees has become a major diplomatic card in Ankara's dealings with the European Union. Turkey has already effectively become a gatekeeper to Europe.
Rückführungsflug organisiert haben nach Afghanistan und wir suchen auch Wege, wie wir das im Hinblick auf Syrien hinkriegen.
Migration and Turkey's hosting of refugees was high on the agenda when German Chancellor Olaf Scholz met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Istanbul earlier this month. Erdogan declared Turkey wouldn't turn away any refugees from Lebanon. But Murat Aslam says a new wave of refugees is a price too high. He's with the SETA Foundation for Political, Economic and Social Research, a pro-government think tank.
Turkey does not want any further waves coming from another region because Turkey is just experiencing and mending an economic crisis. Inflation is currently under control and we expect a decrease in it. So another wave of refugees mean what? A lot spending, a lot inflation, and other than this, societal security. So that's why Turkey will not tolerate another wave.
But such a stance will likely be tested if Israel continues its offensive, creating more refugees, and with it, the risk of Turkey facing a humanitarian crisis on its border. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And a reminder to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. That way you'll make sure that you never miss one of the great stories that we cover every week from across Europe. And now here's a quick preview of another one of DW's podcasts.
Don't drink the milk. Weird name for a podcast, right? But it will all make sense, I promise. And no, it's not a podcast about milk. If you like historical intrigue, a bit of culture and a sprinkling of controversy, this one's for you.
The arguments of homeopathy are based on like sand, and the sand was pouring through my fingers.
I'm Rachel Stewart, and for this new podcast from DW, I'm travelling around Europe, tracing the backstories of objects, ideas and movements that you know well. But maybe you never really stopped to think how these things got to you.
Condoms are known as French letters in the 19th century. Syphilis is the French disease, but in France it's the Italian disease.
Join us to follow the strange journeys of these everyday things and see how they change shape as they're exported through time and around the world, by force, by chance, or by choice. No need to pack your bags. Just subscribe to Don't Drink the Milk wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany.
Thank you.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany. In the next half hour, as Georgia picks its next parliament, what has become of its hopes of joining the EU? How Russia's war economy is fueling a housing affordability crisis?
У нас сейчас на рынке наблюдается парадокс.
Housing prices should be going down right now because interest rates are so high. But actually, housing prices are increasing. Because Russia is cut off from the global economy, Russians who do have money are investing in real estate at home.
Behind a curve on tackling racism, but now football chiefs in Spain are finally taking action. And Italy's plans for more wind and solar power face stiff opposition from locals.
There are plans for more than 200 wind turbines, not just the size of the ones that are already there, which are about 100 meters high, but more than 200 meters high. That's four times the height of the Tower of Pisa.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
Earlier in the show, we heard how pro-Russian groups were accused of sabotaging a referendum in Moldova on whether the former Soviet Republic's plans to join the European Union should be enshrined in the constitution. This weekend, parliamentary elections are being held in another ex-Soviet state, Georgia, which lies south of Russia and is nestled between Turkey, Armenia and Azerbaijan. Georgia, like Moldova, is battling to decide whether to return to Russia's sphere of influence or maintain its pro-Western direction. Last year, Georgia was granted EU candidate status, a first stage towards eventual membership. But that accession process is practically frozen, according to Brussels, because the country's ruling party, Georgian Dream, which has been in power since 2012, is now seeking rapprochement with Moscow. I invited back Denis Chinusha, a political analyst at the Eastern European Studies Centre in Vilnius, to help us try and unpack what this all means.
These elections in Georgia are about continuity of the current government, which is associated with the oligarchic regime that has been running the country since 2012. It's about Bezina Ivanishvili, who is really a very influential politician and public figure in Georgia. And the alternative is obviously the renewal of the democratic landscape in Georgia, and it's about having the opposition political parties that are governing the country in a coalition. So these are two options for Georgia. One is to have a continuity. The other one is to really have fresh blood in the party political system in Georgia, which obviously will have consequences for the foreign policy of the country. If we change the current dynamics for political life in Georgia, then we will obviously see very positive trends in terms of restoring the good dialogue with the EU, with the West, with NATO, and in general, somehow seeing more freedom in terms of fundamental rights for the citizens in Georgia, because this is something that is at stake when we look at these particular elections.
Now, Denis, polls suggest that Georgian Dream, the ruling party, is going to gain the most votes in this weekend's election, but that the four pro-EU opposition parties could align and still beat them. How likely do you think that is, given the backsliding towards autocracy?
I believe that they are quite successfully using the limited opportunities they have on the ground. And when I speak about limited opportunities, that's the access to the media, that's the funds, that's also about how they are portrayed by the government and by the party propaganda. Russia is also reinforcing certain of those narratives using its own channels. So the opposition parties didn't manage to really create one movement, because that was seen by some political experts in Georgia as a risky strategy, because that would expose all of them against Georgian propaganda in terms of what the ruling party is doing, as well as that it will be criticized by certain parts of the electorate that doesn't really associate with all the political parties. For instance, the UNM party, the party of Saakashvili, is not supported by many Georgians. You know, they actually don't like this political party. So if the opposition was one monolith political movement, then it would affect all of them. So it's good that they are many and that they can really appeal to different parts of the electorate. But in my view, they don't have enough time to really mobilize the vote. And I think that this is the main risk, that there is not enough time and that they don't have the same capacity as, for instance, Moldova to mobilize the diaspora. And neither the government is creating these facilities for the Georgians abroad to take part in the elections.
Now, last year, Brussels offered EU candidate status to Georgia at the same time as opening membership talks with Ukraine and Moldova. But in Georgia's case, these talks are now on hold. Can you just remind us why that is?
Well, the EU has been seeing decisions that were adopted by the Georgian government, which are completely out of place when it comes to compliance to certain principles. I speak about the law on foreign agents, which is very much a replica of what we know being implemented in Russia since 2012. So the EU is right to actually put on hold the candidate status for Georgia, but it has to be very careful. It should not punish the population because the population is in its majority pro-EU. So yeah, it's very hard for the EU to navigate this very diverse sensitivities in Georgia because they have in a way to sanction the government for not implementing what it is required from it. Sanctions also have social political consequences, which means losing support in Georgia if this is not implemented correctly and it is not communicated properly.
And finally, Dennis, what sense do you get from ordinary Georgians caught up in this tug of war for whether the country looks towards Russia or the West in future?
They are losing the opportunity to be as advanced in the relationship with the EU as Moldova and Ukraine, for instance. But at the same time, they are close to Russia. So this idea that the second front can be open, it's obviously a fear that is exploited by the ruling party in Georgia because they know that it traumatized very much the Georgians. They still have two separatist regions, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, that are occupied by Russia. It's about 20% of the country. They know that Russia has military troops in these territories, that they have built military capacities, and that they are actually expanding their influence within this occupied territories. When you talk to Georgians, especially young Georgians in the capital, you'll see a lot of ambitions when it comes to this election. They are very optimistic that it can change the situation. Unfortunately, we have to be also realistic. So the opposition political parties have to prepare for Plan B, which will mean that the Georgian Dream, the ruling party, can try to really get a majority in the next parliament. And in this regard, we have to prepare for the worst case scenarios, even if we would like to see the coalition of pro-EU political parties winning in these elections.
And I was talking there to Denis Chinoucha, a political analyst at the Eastern Europe Study Centre in Vilnius. And while Moscow's influence is dominating the election campaign in Georgia, Russia has its own problems to contend with, namely high inflation as a result of the war in Ukraine. That's partially because the Russian government is spending so much money on defence spending, which is creating jobs and pumping lots of money into the economy. With prices rising, it's becoming very difficult for Russians just to rent an apartment or buy a new home. But as Levi Bridges reports, the Russian government has taken aggressive action by creating subsidized programs to get more people into new homes. And just a note, we're withholding the names of some people in this story to protect them from possible retaliation.
Recently, a young Russian man put a video on YouTube documenting his experience moving out into the woods in far eastern Russia, where he started a farm raising sled dogs. Tall, shady fir trees rise up around the kennel. Over the phone, he tells me how free he feels living out here in the quiet. He says it's gorgeous out here, the way the light shines through the trees. Reindeer frequently wander through his backyard. He got this awesome plot of land for free. Russia's government has recently given free land out to tens of thousands of people through programs aimed at increasing Russia's rural population. Russians participating in these programs post videos online with DIY tips on how to build your own house or drill a well. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Russia vastly increased these housing programs, even offering subsidized mortgages with rock-bottom interest rates. I talked to one man who said it might have taken him years to buy property without this support. He says, you don't need to be some kind of financial expert to see there's an opportunity here. He's investing in multiple properties with the help of state-backed mortgages, so he can leave an apartment to each of his three children. Russia has been pouring money into the economy since the Ukraine conflict began, not just through social programs, but also defense spending. The war is creating lots of new jobs. Unemployment is at record lows, but inflation is still climbing. This new economic reality has created winners and losers. Tim Fry is a political scientist at Columbia University focusing on Russia.
Government finances are in pretty good shape. The ruble's relatively stable. But people are really feeling the effects of inflation. And there's a lot of anxiety and nervousness in the market.
To calm some of that anxiety, Russia recently canceled a lot of subsidized mortgage programs. At the same time, Russia's Fed has hiked up interest rates to 19% to combat inflation. So now homes are unaffordable for many Russians. I called up a Russian mortgage broker who says Russia's housing market has reached a moment of historic instability.
У нас сейчас на ринку наблюдається парадокс. Цени, вони падають, а
She says housing prices should be going down right now because interest rates are so high. But actually, housing prices are increasing. Because Russia is cut off from the global economy, Russians who do have money are investing in real estate at home. The housing market has gotten so tight that rents in cities like Moscow have gone up 40%. I talked to lots of young Russians who told me they're having to make real sacrifices in order to pay the bills. High rent is even causing homelessness in major cities, and a stressed economy is forcing small businesses to make adjustments.
Okay, so the product number one that every Russian likes is buckwheat.
I talked to a businessman over Zoom who sells goods to Russian immigrants in the U.S. He shows me some of his stock, bags of buckwheat. Russians love buckwheat. Even a calendar with a picture of President Putin walking down the street in a suit and dark sunglasses. Are the sales of Putin calendars going up or down recently?
No, they're just one or two per day. Not many people need it.
Because of new trade restrictions, he isn't able to send as many products to U.S. customers as he used to. Still, he says he's doing tens of thousands of dollars in sales each month. Even if the U.S. launches additional trade restrictions, he's confident he'll stay in business.
We'll find a plan B and plan C. We have them.
The Russian government has also created workarounds to keep the economy relatively stable, says Yulia Pavitska, a Ukrainian researcher who studies Western sanctions.
And this is something that is like cat and mouse game that is endless.
Pavitska says the Ukraine war has created a new class of Russians employed by the defense sector. They're buying new apartments and getting salaries they never dreamed possible. But that makes them beholden to an authoritarian government that is becoming even more authoritarian.
And I think that this grants the regime kind of more long-lasting leverage over the society. These people are not able for any social protests, and it's kind of buying their agreement with the status quo.
It comes at a cost, but there are compelling reasons for Russians to just take what the government is offering. In an Instagram video, one Russian woman shows off a free plot of land she received.
Это круто, что у нас есть свой родник прямо около нашего участка.
Her view looks out over windswept hills at the ocean, and it looks idyllic, but it's eerie to watch against the backdrop of the war. Levi Bridges, DW.
Now, it may be the most popular sport in the world and regarded as a great uniter of people, but football also has its dark side. Racism, homophobia, sexism and violence have long blighted the game. Spain, often criticised for not having clear strategies in place to deal with racism in football, is working hard to change this. And to highlight the work being done, this week La Liga, the Spanish Football League, organised a forum to discuss and debate what more needs to be done. Inside Europe's Ashish Sharma went along.
It was only last season when one of the biggest stars of La Liga, Real Madrid's Vinicius Jr., had an effigy dangling over a bridge before a derby game. Vinicius has faced more racial abuse than any other player, and recently he implored FIFA to take the World Cup away from Spain in 2030 unless it could control racism in football.
El odio, el odio, el odio es nuestro peor rival.
Contra el que más duele perder. El odio es la mayor lacra de nuestra sociedad.
La Liga used this forum to highlight measures it has taken, such as surveillance technology in identifying perpetrators, plus a rollout of educational programs, but says it's powerless in handing out punishments. It can only report incidents to the Special Prosecutor's Office against hate crimes and discrimination. Jose Montero, head of La Liga's institutional relations, was one of the event organizers.
Sin presencias, un acto racista, repórtalo.
And this is the work we are doing, because the only way we think we can do the things is if we change the laws. And we have laws a little bit harder to those that are trying to humiliate other people. This is a big issue. And we are asking to the government and some other authorities, we are asking them to have more competences, to have the right to punish in case of the episodes we find out about. At this point, it's going to be difficult because I think the governments are not very on favor that private organizations will have that chance.
The racism debate also revolved around one minority group here in Spain, which is amongst the least represented in both the men's and women's game.
The majority of countries in Europe, the Roma community don't finalize the secondary school, and the discrimination is very big in all Europe.
Sara Jimenez, Spain's representative in the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, highlighted the problems that Roma communities face, in particular women.
I think the problems of the Roma women in your families don't have the support, in some cases don't have the possibility, the economic possibility to have a career professional. And I think it's the possibility of the education, the possibility of the professional career in the sport of the Roma women is more difficult, and the role of the Roma women. And there are an important opportunity to have reference of the other Roma women in the sport.
Auri Boquesa, a former basketball player and also an Olympic athlete.
My name is Cindy Lima, and I used to be also a professional basketball player and an Olympic as well. There is absolutely some problems who have to be addressed. When there is a racist act, young children can see it on the TV live. We need sometimes in the same moment that's happening, show the image of the punishment of the person who did that.
You've both been successful, you're both black women in your sports. How difficult was it?
The issue that I have with my identity. I was representing Spain since I was 12 years old. The first time we became European champions, I didn't want the flag of the country. I was not able to put the flag in my shoulders like my other colleagues, because it was like, okay, I know that there is a lot of white people that is not going to be happy about this, and also I know that there is a lot of migrants that they are not going to be happy neither. So I had a lot of problem with my identity. For me, it's important to talk about this.
Has that changed then? Or do you still think that young black people representing Spain will probably think twice about, I don't want to wear that flag, actually.
Sometimes have to do if the person had been born in Spain or not. There is still this, like, Spanish, you black, but you been born here, or you get the national. With that being said, I think if it was, like, in France, for example, that in the national team they have 10 black players, that in Spain, in 2 days, that would be a problem. Mm-hmm. In 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I hope no. But today, that will be a huge problem.
Spanish football is working hard to eradicate racism. it still attracts the best players in the world and has two of the most iconic teams in Real Madrid and Barcelona. That is its greatest selling point. But each time it has to deal with high-level examples of racist abuse, it'll be wary of tarnishing its reputation. Ashish Sharma, DW Madrid.
Still to come, after taking the lead in renewable energy, Italy now finds itself trying to play catch-up. And if you have any thoughts on any of the reports you hear, do get in touch. You can drop a line to insideeurope@dw.com and we'll be back in touch. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany. More than a decade ago, Italy was one of the first EU countries to achieve the bloc's so-called 20-20-20 energy goals. By the year 2020, three objectives had to be met: a 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, raising the share of energy produced by renewables to 20%, and a 20% improvement in energy efficiency. Italy crushed the renewable energy target well before that deadline, but in recent years, the transition to sun, wind and hydropower has come to a near standstill. To meet new targets, Italy must quickly install more solar panels and wind turbines, but resistance is growing. There have been large protests in Apulia and Sardinia, as well as around Lake Bolsena, about 80 kilometres north of Rome, from where Angelo van Schaik reports.
Maria Ciminelli and her husband own a house close to Lake Bolsena. They bought it 3 years ago as a second home. It's an old farm in a very nice area, with a big dog running around in the garden. The view is spectacular, with pine woods covering the surrounding hills.
We still live in Rome, but we bought this house 3 years ago to enjoy the view. But we're victims of political decisions that have been made. Around 500 meters from our home, there's now a big pole to measure the amount of wind in the area. And on that spot, there's going to be a wind turbine about 200 meters high.
From the Belvedere of Montefiascone, nearby, the view is spectacular. Right in front of me is the largest volcanic lake in Italy, surrounded by hills with olive trees and vineyards. But besides olives and grapes, there are also around 30 100-meter-high wind turbines on the hills. And there'll be a lot more of those wind turbines, and they will be a lot higher, says Monica Tomasi. She's president of Italia Nostra, an organization that's been protecting Italy's cultural and environmental heritage since the 1950s.
There are plans for more than 200 wind turbines, directly around the lake as well as a bit further away towards the sea. And not just the size of the ones that are already there, which are about 100 meters high, but more than 200 meters high. That's four times the height of the Tower of Pisa. And that means an enormous impact on the landscape here.
So, probably there's a lot of wind here, so a lot of energy is produced.
Absolutely not. This is not a windy area at all. These wind turbines produce relatively little energy, around 1,800 hours a year. And the year has 8,760 hours. So the wind turbines are not even very useful.
Earlier this year, representatives from environmental organizations, mayors from around the country, and ordinary citizens gathered for a protest in Rome. They say the energy transition is devastating Italy, and that, in particular, sparsely populated areas are experiencing a proliferation of wind turbines, areas that rely mainly on tourism and agriculture, such as Lake Bolsena and its surrounding area, says Antonio Rizzello. He's the mayor of Grotta di Castro, one of the many picturesque villages around the lake.
I am absolutely not against renewable energy. On the contrary, I am very much in favor of it. But I'm concerned about the way plans are implemented. Big multinationals come here to invest millions and are able to easily take over land from owners without people knowing. I am also concerned about the areas where these turbines are planned. I don't want to lapse into the "not in my backyard" rhetoric. That would be hypocritical, as everyone has to contribute. But I believe there are enough run-down industrial areas where installations can be built without ruining the beautiful spots around the lake.
Sorry? Just to show you, I just wanted to show you the two fields where and where everything's happening. You can see quite easily.
James Graham shows me around his garden. Together with his Italian wife, he's been living for 12 years now in the hills not far from Lake Bolsena.
So these are our two amazing trees. They're 450 years old. So the other side of this fence, literally 5 meters away, that is where they will start their agrivoltaic project. Basically, it means that each line of panels will be spaced around about 4 or 5 meters apart. 70 hectares means that, more or less as far as the eye can see, before this hazelnut plantation's over there. And then on the top of the hill over there, there's probably about 800 metres away, right on the top of that. That's where the wind turbine will go.
The big question is why. According to experts, the turbines produce relatively little energy. Mayors and inhabitants see their surroundings ruined, and even the Ministry of Culture is against the turbines. So, I call the Ministry of Environment and Energy Security.
Buongiorno.
For more than a week, I try to talk to someone at the ministry. But after a few emails and several phone calls, the press office still knows nothing. Back to Maria Ciminelli and her house in the hills. It looks like her clear view of the countryside is coming to an end.
È finito, diciamo, la vista.
Yes, it's over. It's an invasion, because besides this turbine already close by, there will be another six of these monsters, a bit further away, but still. When I bought the house 3 years ago, I didn't know anything about this project. No one told us anything. I discovered the plans by myself. Together with other residents of the area, we officially protested. We hope to have a response by the end of this year.
Italy is struggling to keep up with the energy transition. There are so many sites of historical and archaeological importance that there are strict rules about where renewable energy projects can be situated. And a relatively high population density means that suitable spots for wind turbines and solar panels are rare. They're already producing less green energy than Germany and Spain. But concentrating all of the country's wind turbines in just a few areas is leading to protests. So while Italy has to boost renewable energy to meet EU standards, the big questions are where and how. Angelo von Schaik, DW, Lake Bolsena, Italy.
And thanks for making Inside Europe a regular on your podcast playlist. If you've already hit the subscribe button, maybe you'd like to also give us a review, as it will help to promote our show to other listeners. This programme was produced by Helen Sini and sound engineer Michael Springer. And I'm Nick Martin. Thanks for listening. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Germany.